Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Wisdom Chat. My name's Phil Holdsworth and I'm your host, and my guest today is Ohad Kotler, who is the General Manager of Europe for Rise Up. Ohad, you spent sort of time, quite a few years in the finance industry. You were global head of retail investment products at ING. So tell us a little bit about yourself. Welcome, by the way. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thank you very much. And it's a pleasure to be here. And thank you, Phil, for hosting. So indeed, you kind of, that's my name and what I do. I'm part of Rise Up. Before that, spent many years in the financial industry in banking. Before that, I was in McKinsey advising large banks globally on different strategic dimensions. And I think over the last few years, had the real passion to be able to do something that is purpose-driven, impact-oriented in the financial services space, and hence the big opportunity to join Rise Up. And now we are expanding into Europe, and as one of the leading players in this world of financial well-being, it's a great privilege, actually, to be part of this company.
Well, it's great to have you with us today. Now, Rise Up, tell our listeners a little bit about who is Rise Up? What's Rise Up about? How did it begin?
So Rise Up is a company that aims to help people feel at ease with at their financial state, to reduce stress, enable them to live in peace with their money. As a whole, as you know, and we've talked about it before, research shows that stressed individuals perform less well in deep thinking, in social situation, in mental capacity. And 80% of the people, even more if you're talking about employed individuals, reported they suffer or they feel worry, they feel anxiety when it comes to financial well-being. With that, Rise Up has formed itself over the last few years as really a leading player in finding the right balance to help people in that, combining dimensions of technology, asset, content, community, and kind of helping each other working together at scale to help people live better with their money.
Right. That's great. And I'm just thinking in terms of what you're saying there, Ohad, we've sort of had bits of conversations about financial well-being, and there's a number of definitions going around in the industry about what financial well-being is, but we just wanted to tackle in a way, what is true financial well-being? I mean, how do you approach it as an organization, Rise Up?
Right. So let me start actually in talking about well-being, right?
Yeah.
Well-being is, and then I will look at the definition, it's the state of being comfortable, healthy, or happy, right? Sounds very reasonable, very broad, very in contradiction to what we just described about what financial state provides people or how money feels to most people, right? And then if you think about the role of technology over the last decade or more, it has been evolving to take a bigger and bigger part in helping people achieve well-being in their lives. If you think about 10 years ago, Fitbit coming into our lives and kind of adjusting our physical well-being, or 5 years ago, where Headspace is becoming bigger and bigger and improving our mental well-being, what Rise Up tries to do today is to do the same step into the world of financial well-being, introducing technology-enabled ways to feel comfortable, healthy, and happy, and investing in your own future as part of that. And I think it's important to say that this is a problem that is not really being solved today. With finances being both complicated and confusing for most people, it's actually a state that the financial industry seems to some extent thrive on, right? To many players, and it's not coming out of any negative or bad wishes, it's just that it's not in anyone's interest to actually solve this problem. It's not aligned with the interest, like the customer's interest to relieve that anxiety, or the individual's interest to get there, is not aligned with the financial industry's interest, because the entire business model is not built on the same thing. The business model of the financial industry as a whole is a zero-sum game, where if I give you more things, I lose more. And that creates the big challenging dimensions in this collaboration. Yeah. And what shows, kind of what explains why many people feel anxious as they live their lives from month to month with uncertainty about their future or their ability to provide for future kids, etc.
Yeah, I can understand that. When I think about the finance industry and for example, the level of debt that the UK alone, in terms of credit card debt, carries compared, say, to the whole of Europe. I know we're not part of Europe anymore, but having said that, it amounts to about a third of the credit card debt of the whole of Europe. That's a huge amount for one nation. And yet, if it didn't have that debt, there's a lot of money being made out of it. So if it didn't have that debt, that money wouldn't be made in the same way. But there doesn't seem to be any motivation to look at, well, if we got people or a nation to a place where it's no longer indebted, but we change that course so that we then become creative and think of other ways in which finances can be generated other than out of debt. At the moment, there doesn't seem to be that incentive to really tackle the issue. So there's a lot of people working around this. You and I are part of that mix. But it's, I think it was something that was said, it was said about the poor. The poor will always be with us. Okay. So the assumption then is, well, why bother? But you bother because you care about people. So you want to make a difference in people's lives. And so therefore you do. However, we're not just talking about poor, are we? We're talking about people who feel anxious about money. And those people could be people with money.
Absolutely. And I think that the prevalence of challenge or of pain, of uncomfortableness with the topic of money is incredible. It's almost ubiquitous, right? Kind of across industries, across income levels. Of course, in many cases, that type of pain looks different, right? The type of what exactly bothers you about money will not be 100% consistent. Well, for some people, it will direct itself naturally more towards how do I start saving? Well, for others, it's about how do I invest and how much do I need to invest? What is my view of financial plan? Am I meeting my kind of my short, long-term goal? If I want to buy a house, will that be possible? What changes do I need to do today, etc.? All of that knowledge is, or all that sense of control of understanding where that state stands for me personally is something that's incredibly difficult to achieve.
It
has many dimensions to take into account.
Yeah, I was thinking about a typical question I ask people, and that is, in a word, what does money mean to you? And you can get all sorts of responses. So from freedom, choice, power, security, and the list can go on. And so my next question then is, okay, well, how much would you need to feel those things? And it's interesting, that's the point where people stop, and you can see them thinking very quickly because nobody's really ever asked them that question before. And whatever figure they come up with, you can guarantee, well, they might as well just double it, treble it, quadruple it, because it's as if they're looking for an answer in money that money can't give them. Even though money is a tool to help, it can't give them some of the things they're actually looking for. And I just think as well, with regards to views that people hold, and not views, beliefs, but it's called beliefs, values and beliefs that people hold. I'll give you an example, and I alluded to this earlier, but I visited a tourist destination in Norway some years back called Pulpit Rock. It's 1,000 feet above a Norwegian fjord, and it's a straight drop from the plateau at the top straight down into the sort of the edge of the fjord. You wouldn't survive if you fell. That's without question. The thousands flock to this plateau because of the fantastic views. On this one occasion, my wife and I made our way to the top, a few hours walk and climb, and near the top, the pathway narrows very slightly. And at that point, this young lady was stuck against the cliff face. And you could tell that she was full of fear. So we stopped to see if we could help. And we said to her, you know, why can't you move? And she said, I'm afraid I'm going to fall. I've just got this feeling that I'm going to trip up and I'm going to fall over the edge. Well, the pathway was too big for her to do that. She could walk away from the edge. And even if she tripped up, she wouldn't fall over the edge. But in her thinking, because of her fear of heights, she could only see catastrophe happening. So her fear incapacitated her. So it was through the help that we gave that we were able to give her confidence or build her confidence to enable her to move on and join the party that hadn't realized they'd left her behind. And it really struck me, that sometimes we can have beliefs about our relationship with money, that all of the technology, all of the education, the literacy, the guides, the supports won't address and don't address as it presently stands. And I just thought, where do we cover that in financial well-being? A lot said there, you know, I appreciate that. But I think it's a very important point as part of us, we're talking about financial well-being, to deal with, well, what about those hidden beliefs and those values that we hold that we took on board from childhood? How about dealing with some of those?
Absolutely. And I think the way we think about that point or how to help people there, we refer to the academic analysis of Albert Bandura, who died a few years back, that talked about self-efficacy. And self-efficacy is all about the individual's ability, or let's say skill and will, to be able to change their own state. And to be able to achieve that self-efficacy, we talk about four pillars that are required to achieve that continuous self-efficacy. It's about a sense of control, a sense of support that you're not alone. It's about the voice of authority that helps you, kind of supports you and guides you towards that a direction that gives you clarity where you need to go. And it's about seeing other people succeed. And when you see other people succeed, you're feeling you're building additional layers of that self-efficacy in yourself. Now, building that self-efficacy allows people to gradually become more and more independent in and believing in their own ability to change their state. And what we really put a lot of effort and a lot of thought into is to how to help people build their own financial self-efficacy. How do you create, how do you change their own money beliefs? How do you change the perception of I'm good with money or I'm bad with money? Which of course is it's a very simplified, unreasonable look at the world. Now, you can say something interesting on both sides. If you are with the belief of I'm good with money, well, Michael Jordan had a coach, right? And many other top athletes continuously get coached and helped because there's always room to grow and you can always be better. If your self-belief is I'm bad with money, there it comes back to building that identity of I can be good with money, or I am a good person with money, and giving yourself confidence by taking actions one at a time, small steps every time, to create those nudges to yourself to say, hey, I'm able to do it. If I compare that to your story, being able to do that one first step on that tall rock bridge. It's looking at others. It's having someone like you supporting and saying, hey, I believe in you. You are able to do that. The combination of those things starts changing something inside us. And that change is relieving. It's releasing. It's empowering. It really does create a completely different sense. And that's something we focus on, is what we are trying to give with what we do at Rise Up.
I heard recently somebody say to me, you know, from a financial coach point of view, we don't look back because that's for the counselors. That's therapy. And we deal with the here and now, and we look forward. And I thought, well, we're missing something there, because this ties in with what you're saying. How do you build self-efficacy if you don't understand yourself? If you don't understand why you think the way you do, if you can't unpick those beliefs and those unconscious habits that you default to. And it's interesting, in behavioral science, they actually talk very much of people under forms of duress or pressure or time bound to make important financial decisions. So your investment managers, when they're making decisions in the market on behalf of their clients to manage their client portfolios, what influences their decision-making process? And one of the things that they said, that when they are under stress, very often they will default to or move to their default position of choices. Their default position can be an unconscious position. An example would be, if somebody is risk-averse, then if they're put under pressure to make a decision, they will most likely make a decision that avoids any risk. But if they're embracing of risk and they're put under pressure, they most likely will make a decision that, despite the risk, will go down a particular route. So it's interesting, people's behavior and where that behavior comes from, and we say it comes from our values and our beliefs that we develop from year dot up to early 20s. We're going through stages of acting from like sponges to copying others to trying out beliefs ourselves, until we think that we found ourselves in a way. And yet unconsciously, what we might be doing is tripping ourselves up because of a belief that's actually not beneficial for us to be able to move forward. And it's interesting when you're saying what you're saying about self-efficacy, and then individuals say, well, we don't look backwards, that's for the counselors. If we don't at least venture back to where some of these beliefs begin, and help to rewrite the narrative, how do we hope to help a person move forward and gain financial resilience and achieve their future aspirations? It's a challenge, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think one point that this links very nicely into is, who has the responsibility to help? Who has the responsibility to help individuals? Is it's something that starts from the age of zero. And we can assume that part of that is the government, or maybe it's the school, and maybe, and of course, at the end of the day, it's the individuals, and every one of us has their own responsibility on their own lives. But we have institutions that are there to help us evolve and grow. And specifically the institution, and we've talked a lot about it, one of the institutions or one of the places that we have individuals have the most trust in and the most appetite to kind of get support from is employers, right? Mm-hmm. It's the place in which you work, the place where you wake up in the morning trying to make ends meet to earn your bread. That's the place that you want to provide you that financial well-being, right? It's like, that's where you're there at the end of the day, beyond, of course, growth and happiness and enjoying your work with your colleagues. You're trying to live, and living is that financial well-being dimension.
And it is a real opportunity for an employer as well, isn't it? Because when you think about an individual who feels financially resilient, who feels happy and content in life, they're more likely to be fully engaged in their work, more productive, loyal to their workplace, whereas the opposite effect is that people can be in work but not actually really present, that presenteeism. They could be absent through stress-related illnesses. They could even be looking for other work. And the number of times that people they'd rather move jobs rather than actually talk to somebody about the stress that they're experiencing regarding their finances. So at the moment, one of the things that we're finding in the UK is individuals who feel that they're not earning enough or they're not being paid what they feel their value is, would rather move to another company than say anything to their employer. It's an interesting one. So there's a bit of a dichotomy here, because on the one hand, we would more trust the world of employment, generally speaking, not for everybody. But on the other hand, we'd rather not say anything and move somewhere else. And employers would say, well, we don't know the reason, even though they might have an exit interview. The question is, how honest would a person be in the exit interview with regards to their reason for why they're leaving? And I hasten to add, I don't think people would be as honest, because they're concerned, what if I need a reference?
Absolutely. And I think the way I think about it, you mentioned it in the beginning, I really see it as an employer's opportunity.
Right? Yeah.
At the end of the day, employees come in with the hopes to generate financial well-being, regardless of whether they're feeling compensated enough or not. Let's start there for a second. That is a step one. And then, so just to add some statistics on what you were saying, employees that are feeling financially stressed are 4.5 times more likely to be looking for a new job, right? That's it. And they are keen to get help on achieving better financial well-being. It's just that they don't feel comfortable talking or asking. And the topic, of course, is a taboo on its own. So let's start there. The other part is productivity. So you mentioned a few items, but specifically what we see in productivity, most employees spend 3 or more hours a week, like employees who are stressed, 3 or more hours a week on financial concern related thought processes and kind of disconnected from work, to the extent of, you know, the silent resignation, where people really step away from the amount of work and kind of limiting how much they're saying, I'm only paid to work this hard and I'm done. So that is the productivity gap. And the third one is around that loyalty and reputation. The fact that over 60% of employees think that or expect that the employer will do something about their financial well-being. They appreciate that. They want that. If they get something there, that changes their perception of that employer. And changing that perception, and part of the reason employers don't immediately jump into that space is that it's scary. If I'm an employer and I'm touching financial well-being, well, obviously the first thing that I can do is just pay you more. That's what you as an employee would look at me and say, okay, you want me to have financial well-being, give me more money. But of course, the decision of how much a person is being paid is not just based on that, right? It's based on many other considerations and constraints and the business, etc. But there are ways in which you can provide a lot more value and a lot more financial well-being to your employees without renegotiating every salary in the organization in a way that will create chaos, right? You can really address this point around helping your employees. And that's a bit what we, and maybe I can share a bit what we are doing today. We created a set of workshop.
Tell us a little bit about what you're doing at the moment, though.
Yeah. We created something called the Switch Workshop, in which we come to employers and employees, and we run this really snappy 1-hour exercise where we start by building knowledge. We refer to like foundations, financial literacy, if you wish, just so that we have a common ground of understanding how to think about money. The second part we do is what we refer to as the switch. In the switch, we actually try to change, to save people money right there and then on the spot. We split them into groups, we give them assignments. It's a lot of fun. There is confetti at the end. It's a very exciting exercise.
I've got to say this. I saw one of your video clips. Was it like a TikTok clip? Yeah, of you with the confetti bomb that you set off. So I don't know how many people jumped in their seats at that point, but
it looked fun. I always check to see if there is no one with PTSD or anything like that, because it is a loud experience. My ears are starting to get hurt by this, but it's a lot of fun. It's just, you know, one of the things that we're trying to achieve with this is just making money less scary. And yeah, maybe it's a bit silly to have confetti bombs in your employers in the job, but it also lightens up the mood and makes it a shared achievement. And we gain something together on a topic that is so tense, that is so heavy and so uncomfortable. Yeah. When we finish it, what we get is a lot of people coming to us saying, wow, first of all, there's like a completely new layer of my colleagues that I discovered today, because we get them to open up and talk to each other. And the second is I'm realizing that the opportunities that I have with my own finance, whether I'm a super expert and I know my stuff, whether or not, there is a lot that I can do to be at a higher state of financial well-being, what we call the switched people.
Yeah, that's a great approach. And I like the idea of making it fun, because often I'll liken it a little bit like, I don't know, you go to the garage to have your vehicle worked on, to service, maintained. And there was a day when I could open up the bonnet of a car and I knew where certain things were in the car. Nowadays, I open it up and go, oh, close the bonnet and say, I need the expert to deal with this, because it looks so, you know, complex, it's computerized and so on. And it's the same principle in the finance industry. And people often feel afraid of engaging with it because of that complexity. So if we talk about pensions, trying to explain to somebody about pensions or tax, those alone, protection, are very complex areas. And so, like yourself, I very much, you know, focus on simplifying the process. And I know you mentioned the confetti bombs. It's interesting. I remember years ago, I used to work in the investment management world. And I remember designing a then Data Protection Act online course for people. And I thought, what could make it a little bit more fun? Just put a smile on people's faces. So I used cartoon characters, but they were appropriate to the subject matter, just to sort of take the edge off the dryness of the subject. I got somebody coming back to me saying, well, that's a bit demeaning, don't you think? And I'm thinking, you've missed the point. The point is, this is a very, very dry, and when we're talking about the financial side, very difficult subject. And we want people to engage with it, not be frightened by it. And so what you're doing, and perhaps others are, even things like card games, I use an assessment that actually uses either an online tool or a card game. So it's like a pack of cards. But it's great fun, but it's quite revealing of what it helps a person be introduced to themselves. And I think where we can, all of us can do those things, it's a great help. And why shouldn't we simplify it? Because there's enough complications out there, isn't there?
Absolutely. And maybe let me tie that up to a point that we've talked about before. Yeah. The way to achieve, to help people get to the point where they can deal with the high complexity items, you have topics that are inherently complex. Investments or a mortgage or insurances, complex insurance. There is a lot of expertise that you need there. And yes, we need to simplify them. And yes, the many players are trying to create some simplicity. But I think step zero is creating the self-efficacy in the individual. to be able to deal with that, to say, to come to the table, not with the mindset of, oh my God, this is only for the experts. I am a completely incompetent person. What am I doing here? Someone take it away from me, please. Mindset is, hey, I've managed to reduce my mobile bill. Of course, it didn't save millions in the process, but you did that. And then you've managed to reduce how much you spend on groceries by applying these and these tips and tricks in the right way. And you've managed to solve this and that and another switch. And you've managed to converse with your partner about money for the first time. We have something we call now for Valentine's Day, we created a financial date where we give people questions. It's like based on the New York Times structure of 36 questions to talk with their date, with their partner about money. A set of really fun and engaging type of conversation, right?
Brilliant.
Touch these types of switches one by one, you start changing who you are when it comes to money. You're no longer kind of afraid of this big bad monster. You know, you crack this and this and that. Okay, so mortgages will be complicated. Yes, but you're a person that can. You have the efficacy, the self-efficacy, the ability, the skill, and the will to figure it out. And that's what we try to help people with step by step.
That's brilliant. Now, I'm just thinking in terms of time's moved on for us, but just to sort of wrap this up, we were talking about looking at sort of relationship with money. I've kind of touched on that, but I want to just for us to finish on the other element to do with the employer, and that is the barrier to the employer wanting to engage with this, because some employers themselves may feel, well, where do I start? What do I do? How can I engage with this? Isn't this a regulated field? I don't want to be responsible for giving somebody the wrong advice. And yet there's so many out there like ourselves, yourself, Rise Up, and others who are working to support the employer, being able to assist them in improving the financial well-being of their employees. So what would you say to an employer who might be a little bit reticent at this moment in time?
Yeah, well, I think like everything, it starts by wanting to solve the problem, right? The fact that an employer starts taking on themselves the responsibility and the understanding that their employee financial well-being is an opportunity for them to take on. That's step zero. From there, they need to build a bit of their understanding of what do they believe will be impactful and helpful and really move the needle for their employees. Kind of, whether the challenge is in achieving like the right benefits, and that's usually not financial well-being, right? But it is extremely valuable. That's financial money. Whether it's financial literacy, so it's knowledge. It depends on who your employees are, right? If you're working in an accounting firm, probably financial literacy is not that interesting for your employees as a whole. Maybe still, but less so than other types of companies. And then if what you want to touch is really financial well-being, you need to touch a bit of a broader type of support. You need to touch something that touches emotions and relationships. Still requires technology and finance and understanding of money and being able to create expert-led advice. And of course, it goes all the way to the regulated step, which is the personal financial advice. If you go into a person, what you should do with your money, that is very quickly turns into the regulated world. And that as well, you can have an open conversation with multiple people. But once you just need to know not to step into the regulated state. You need to know where your boundaries are in terms of what you can and cannot talk about.
Yeah, I agree with you, Ad. And I just think as well, when it comes to an employer wanting not just the best for the employee, but the best for the company as well, and to build a future resilience for the company, you can deal with benefits packages and things like that as part of a well-being approach. But if that's all you consider, then you're missing some very key aspects of what makes us human. And you could be missing out on some golden opportunities to really make a positive difference in the lives of your employees. And also building that sort of future of the organization, that loyalty that comes with people feeling like I've been supported, I've been looked after, I've been heard, and I'm valued. So, Ohad, thank you so much. I know time has passed us by. Really appreciate that. I'm here in the UK. Tell us where you're based at the moment.
Home is in the Netherlands. Right. I'm here to adapt. Lady, I'm Dutch myself by now, but I come very often to the UK, and we are opening our offices in the UK, in Spain, in the Netherlands. So I'll be around.
Okay. And if people would like to know more about Rise Up, how would they find that out?
They can reach out to us. You can find us at letsriseup.com, or you can reach out to me on LinkedIn, Ohad Kotler, working at Let's Rise Up. Would be a good place to start.
Ohad, it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much. Have a good rest of the day.
Very much.